Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Today is a holiday in Alaska, a day set aside to remember the man who negotiated the U.S. government's purchase of the 49th state. But that deal and its long-lasting implications for the original inhabitants of Alaska put William Henry Seward in a different context for Alaska Natives. We'll look at the man behind Seward's Day and the context of Alaska's purchase nearly a century and a half ago. Conversation starts after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Two federal agencies published their response to a 2023 national report on missing and murdered Indigenous people. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports on what's next.
In 2020, Congress passed the Not Invisible Act. The bill created a commission to develop recommendations on how to best address the MMIP crisis. After conducting listening sessions across the country, they published their final report to the feds. The Department of Justice and Department of the Interior have just responded to it.
The biggest takeaway I have is just the fact that a lot of our resources are not streamlined. It's like a scattershot.
That's enrolled Northern Arapaho tribal member Jordan Dresser. He was part of the Not Invisible Act Commission, and he agrees with the report's takeaway that more coordination between the different agencies is crucial.
When a family's going through something like that, I think they sometimes don't know where to turn to.
The more than 200-page response from the two federal agencies outlines their commitment to continuing to work with tribal communities to find solutions to the crisis. I'm Hannah Haberman.
Now that the North American Indigenous Games Council has approved Arctic sports on a trial basis for its 2027 Games in Calgary, fans of Native Youth Olympics hope the Games can spread beyond Northern tribes. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, a team of athletes from Juneau, Alaska, visited schools in Kansas and New Mexico.
In Arctic sports, team members encourage each other to strive for their personal best, so it's not unusual for athletes to cheer on their opponents. In that spirit, Kyle Worrell, the head of the Native Youth Olympics program for Juneau schools, took a team of six athletes on tour.
Every school and community we've gone to, they've been very engaged.
The team demonstrated seven games: the 1 foot and 2 foot high kick, the Alaskan high kick, scissor broad jump, seal hop, and the Inuit and Dene stick poles, which today are part of friendly competitions that require strength, agility, and endurance, necessary for traditional hunters to hop over ice floes or carry heavy loads for long distances. Worrell says everywhere they went, students showed interest in the games and their history.
This sport really resonates with Indigenous people. It's about community, and I think all tribes know that community is really important.
Worrell is hopeful the sport can take root at the Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas, which has two Alaskan athletes who can help with the coaching. The team also traveled to the nearby Kickapoo Nation School to plant some seeds among kids who are not yet in college. Worrell says the Juneau athletes gave them a chance to try out the games for themselves, which they seem to enjoy.
To be able to be in a space where your Indigenous identity is represented and honored, and you feel a sense of belonging.
The Juneau team also traveled to New Mexico to visit the Santa Clara Pueblo Tribal School, the Santa Fe Indian School, and the Institute of American Indian Art. They left behind kits with equipment that included a kickstand, a hand-sewn sealskin ball, and two types of sticks. Worrell says the Calgary Games are 4 years out, plenty of time to train for NYO Games. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
New Mexico's congressional delegation announced last week $10 million for multipurpose facilities for seven tribes in the state. The funding is under the U.S. Department of the Treasury's Capital Projects Fund to invest in New Mexico's Tribal Library Broadband Ready Facility Improvement Program. The program will construct a new child care center and expand six libraries and family resource centers to boost services and also provide broadband and computers. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members serve to alleviate poverty while earning money for college and gaining professional skills. Rewarding service opportunities can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Today is the Alaska State Holiday Seward's Day. It commemorates the purchase of Alaska by the United States from Russia in 1867, a purchase negotiated by William Henry Seward. At the time, the purchase drew criticism for the large sum for what was considered by outsiders as a frozen wasteland. The discovery of gold and other resources changed that view. But the sale has other lasting criticisms by Alaska Native residents, a feature that is noted in a totem pole with Seward's likeness. We'll get to that later in the show. First, we'll get some perspectives on the purchase of Alaska from people who study it from a variety of viewpoints. And we also want to hear from you, our listeners. Are you from Alaska? If so, what were you taught about the purchase of Alaska? What do you know about William Seward? Join our conversation today with a comment or question. You can call us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. You can also leave a comment or question on our website or social media pages. Joining us now from Montgomery, Alabama, is Dr. Lee Farrow. She is a historian, an author, distinguished research and teaching professor at Auburn University at Montgomery. Welcome to Native America Calling, Lee. Great to have you.
Hi, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Joining us from Anchorage, Alaska is Benjamin Jasek. He is a researcher at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. He is Dena'ina, Athabascan, and Chupiak. Good morning, Brian, and welcome back to our show.
Hey, yeah, you do. Good to be here.
Good to have you. Joining us from Las Vegas, Nevada is Kurt Chamberlain. He is Assistant General Counsel for the Chalista Corporation, and he is a member of the Native Village of Aniak. Hello, Kurt, and welcome back to the show as well.
Hi, Sean. Thank you for having me.
And joining us from New York is Stephen Jackson, also known as Jackson Polys. He is a multidisciplinary artist and a carver. He is Tlingit. Hello, Jackson, and welcome to our show.
Hi, happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to have all of you on the show today. And Lee, I want to go ahead and start off with you today. You wrote a book, and it's titled Seward's Folly, and it's a reexamination of the purchase of Alaska. And please start us off. Just explain to our listeners, what else is there to the story of the U.S. government buying Alaska that isn't talked about quite so much?
So the thing that inspired me to write the book in the first place is a visit to Alaska years ago. And when I was there, I looked for sort of a current history of the Alaska purchase because I knew very little about it myself. I'm a Russian historian by trade, and I realized I didn't know very much about it. And I couldn't find anything that had been written, and it had been since like the 1970s. So I decided to look into it a little more. And one thing I discovered is that the books that were out there, aside from being older, also didn't discuss the international reactions to the purchase. We always think about the Russian or the Alaska purchase just in terms of Russian-American relations, but there was a much larger audience for this purchase as well, and that was the rest of the world. And the 19th century was a really busy time in European affairs. So I wanted to look at that as well.
And what were some of those findings with regard to the international impact beyond just the United States and Russia?
So it proved to be very, very interesting. The other countries in Europe were really alarmed by this exchange because they did see the potential there for some kind of alliance. Now, of course, that never really came to pass, but they were worried. And of course, this is the age of, you know, the 19, 19th century, we're talking about Italian unification, German unification, you know, the shifting of the balance of power in Europe, the ultimate collapse, you know, the impending collapse of the Ottoman Empire. So there were a lot of things happening, and people were worried about the, you know, the shifting dynamics of international relations. And this deal between Russia and the United States, which seemed really too good to be true, in some ways, was definitely alarming because it seemed to imply that there was something else going on there, like maybe they were actually looking for some kind of alliance.
That really is interesting, especially in the context that would have been Tsarist Russia at the time then. That would have been long before the revolution.
Right, exactly. Mm. But there was so much going on at the time in Europe that, you know, any kind of shifting alliances, you know, was something that was of great concern.
Okay. Well, let's talk about William H. Seward. What can you tell us about him as a person? What was his background? And what else was he known for besides the Alaska Purchase?
Well, I mean, he was a politician with a lot of skills. He was known to be incredibly charming. He's from New York. People talked about him having a big personality, and apparently he had a foul mouth, but a very good sense of humor. And he, you know, he served in the government for quite a number of years. He was governor of New York, and then he served alongside Lincoln. A lot of people don't know he was actually injured in the attack on Lincoln. Seward was also attacked at his home, and was incapacitated for quite a time after that. But he is most known for the Alaska Purchase, probably. Long before the Alaska Purchase even was a possibility, Seward was giving speeches talking about the necessary expansion of the United States. He was a true expansionist. He believed it was our destiny to eventually dominate the entire North American continent.
Okay, so let's take it back now, 1867, William H. Seward, Alaska Purchase. During that time, was there any mention of Alaska Native people or how they would be impacted through this purchase or what their role was or wasn't in any of that process?
Sadly, there was very little worry about what the people who were already living there believed. And that had been true for a very long time. The discussions about the Alaska Purchase, the earliest discussions actually started during the Crimean War. Russia was concerned that that it was possible that maybe Great Britain would just grab Alaska since it was already in, you know, what would become Canada. And so there were a lot of concerns. And so there were people who started to think about the possibility of maybe some kind of sale at that point. But then nothing ever came to pass. And so that sort of shelved for the moment after the Crimean War. But there were people in Russia who continued to think that this was an important thing, and it was something that would be beneficial to Russia. Alaska just didn't seem to serve the needs of Russia the way it had before. But in all of these kinds of conversations, no one was ever talking about the Native people. This was entirely viewed as they were viewed as you know, unimportant in these conversations between big powers. So there really wasn't any discussion of it. Now, when it came time for the actual sale, there were discussions of how to resettle people if they wanted to move someplace. There had been, of course, a lot of intermarriage by the time that the sale took place. And so that became a big conversation about whether or not people who had intermarried wanted to stay in Alaska or if people wanted to try and go back to Russia, if that's where they were from. But there really was little concern for the Native people, I'm afraid to say.
And what was the purchase price, Lee?
$7.2 million. That's the one thing everybody knows about about the Alaska Purchase. It's really funny because, you know, when I was writing this book, I would ask my students, and that was pretty much the only thing they knew about it. And and the name Seward's Folly, which, as I explained in my book, was really a name that was not given to it until later. There were doubts and a lot of arguing. There was a lot of arguing on Capitol Hill about this purchase, but it had more to do with, you know, personal grudges and philosophical differences than it really did with the idea that it was just a wasteland. That was some public perception, but on Capitol Hill, it really had a lot to do with these kinds of things that we see happening even today on Capitol Hill, right? Personal grudges and so on.
And in Alaska felt that it was the right thing to do to sell the land. Were there any dissenting opinions, though? Were there people there in Russia that thought, hey, this isn't a great idea? And in hindsight, maybe Russia probably thinks, geez, we really let that go for a bargain.
Yeah, well, and of course, you probably know that there are still people today in Russia who think they should be able to get it back. When I was, after I wrote this book, I was actually sent by the Department of State to Russia for 10 days, and I gave talks there. And every single place I gave a talk, there was at least one person in the audience who raised the question of whether or not the sale was legitimate, whether or not it had been some kind of scam. There were accusations that we didn't pay everything or that it was really just a lease, not a sale. So there are still people who are clinging to the idea that Alaska perhaps really still rightfully belongs to Russia or should be Russian territory in the future.
All right. Well, Leah, I want to thank you for kicking off our conversation and just providing some great context here on Seward's Day in history on the purchase of Alaska. And at this point, let's bring Benjamin into the conversation now. Benjamin Jasek, he is a researcher at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. And Benjamin, on a personal level, what do you think of Seward's Day? What does it mean to you?
Really, what Seward's Day to me really symbolizes is that continuing narrative of kind of the invisibility of Native peoples. Just as was talked about so expertly before, really there wasn't as much concern about Native peoples throughout the entire purchase of Alaska, which really paved the way for future conversations to be able to exclude, Native voices throughout the entire, about things that really involve our entire, every aspect about our life.
All right. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Benjamin, and we're going to look at that history there and why did Russia start making claims to Alaska in the first place? We're going to explore that question as well with Benjamin, and we've got a lot more to talk about here on Seward's Day with our other guests, and I encourage anyone listening today, especially our listeners in Alaska, give us a call. What do you think of Seward's Day? Tell us what you feel. Tell us what you're thinking. Tell us what you know about the history. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Stay with us. We'll be right back. An Oklahoma non-binary teen suicide following a fight at school is sparking widespread conversations about the consequences of bullying. Numerous studies indicate schools are a frequent setting for bullies who exploit differences to make others feel bad. We'll discuss some successful strategies for curbing bullying on the next Native America Calling.
Ah, Hesbuk ani, Spousbuk ani, Liatwa, Nequets Ethan to Hess Ethan, Nequets Quakwaman Sue, Unai Quin Kimels, Mhets just in Tauch to us Baus, Sellant to on Puch Bahut, Etzis Chen to us in Quelius Mammies, Chokol Telsent to on in Kalius Such Mariam, Quil Neltsami, Quischquim at healthcare.gov, Uhaj Quokol Telsent 1-800-318-2596, Yet Mammy, and Centers Quil Medicare U Medicaid Services.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce, and we are talking about Seward's Day and the 1867 purchase of Alaska. If you have a comment or question about the purchase of the state, join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And our guest right now, Benjamin Jasek, is with the Alaska Native Heritage Center. He's in Anchorage, Alaska. And Benjamin, let's go back before this purchase. Let's go back to Russia when they first laid claim to the territory of Alaska. And why did they do that? And what was their motivation for claiming that territory?
Thank you very much. Yeah. So for with a lot of things connected with, colonization, it really has to do with the resources that are in the area. The resources that they found at the very beginning had to do with the sea otter, fur seal trade, where they thought that was going to be really the big revenue-generating reality for, considering Alaska. And so really had to do with the fur at that time, with the Russians.
All right. So this would have been before the gold, before the oil, sea otters, seals, resources mm-hmm. such as that. Okay.
Now, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
And then after Alaska became a U.S. territory, what did that mean for Alaska Native people? How did their lives change? What was different?
So it really is very dependent upon what area of Alaska you were at. For most of coastal Alaska, that's where you see the most Russian, influence. And depending on, what part, if you're in the interior, there was a lot less Russian influence, obviously, because there's not too many sea otter over in the interior. If you were on the, Aleutian chain, Unangas, Supiak, you saw large amounts of slavery coming about as a result, a lot of, our family members became enslaved or just were absolutely massacred. And so that's one thing that highlights a lot of this period. Now, in terms of, church, our Orthodox Church relationships compared to, the trappers or the fur traders, that would be a whole different conversation that would probably take up a whole entire time slot.
All right. Well, it's important for us to remember just how big Alaska is. So, yeah, I would imagine that it would just be the impacts would be very different based on different parts of the state, different cultures as well. Let's take a caller now. Chief Gary Harrison is listening. KNBA. Good morning, Chief Harrison. Thank you for joining us.
This Litoff Memorandum Descriptive that the Russians wrote for the United States when they said that they purchased Alaska. And really what it says is that they only purchased two forts on two islands and they never got into mainland Alaska. There's only trading post.
All right, looks like we dropped Chief Harrison, but Benjamin, that was interesting. I heard him say that this whole idea of them purchasing all the Alaska territory, not so, according to this document, just a very small portion, two ports. Is that true?
Oh, I just cut out. I'm sorry. What was the question? Sorry.
Oh, we just had a caller who mentioned that the original documents were not the whole. It was just a small portion of Alaska that's actually listed as being sold in that original document, not the whole state or the whole territory, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, and that would be something more for the legal experts to talk about later on. It was at least Seward's idea or understanding that it was the entire state.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Chief Harrison, are you there? Okay, let's take another caller. Chanupa, are you there? Are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay, Sean?
Yeah, Chanupa in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Thanks, Chanupa.
Hey, to that brother that's speaking about a lot of our Aleuts and our Eskimos, Tsimsheans, and all the brothers up there, remember, there's a small piece that I think he knows about it, that fully the land of Alaska was never really ceded rather than purchase, okay? There's two different definitions, and some of the legal experts can marginalize on that. But back in the days, my people used to talk about that long, long time ago because some of the Aleuts and Tsimsheans and the other ones, they would come down here bringing muktuk and pickled salmon to trade with our people, okay? And a lot of the elders passed on, but they used to tell us that stuff. And so we had a common exchange commerce. I mean, we're the ones who invented it in the first place, and then the white America got here. But one of the things we're not understanding, truthfully, and this brother can clarify it real carefully. The Eskimo people and the Aleuts, they constitute more of a majority of the Alaska population. And what he said was true about how the Russians, you know, did their part, and then, but in overall, that land still has a title affected back to the people, because you cannot remove a people or you cannot exchange a land without full consensus of the Eskimos, Aleuts, Tsimsheans, and everyone else that still hold dear to their traditional culture. That's what I want to contribute, because I think somewhere in the Supreme Court, they acknowledge that. That authority goes back to those brothers and sisters that occupy Alaska. Hokai from Pine Ridge.
All right. Thank you, Chinupa. And Chief Harrison, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. I'm sorry, Chief Harrison. I've got a technical issue on my end, but please go ahead. Go share your thoughts again.
Well, what's going on is the fact that the Kozlitzov Memorandum Descriptive, which came from Russia after the United States asked what did they really purchase, said that they only purchased two forts on two islands. And if you read the Treaty of Cession in the last part, it says that they're only selling to the United States what interest it has in it. And that's why they say the Memorandum Descriptive shows that they've never really purchased Alaska, just the trading rights. So that's one of the things that people don't understand. And they never really decolonized Alaska according to the UN Charter, which basically says only the original people are supposed to vote on decolonization. And on the books at the time was a law saying you had to prove you could speak and write English and have five white people sign that you were competent if you were a native. So who voted for Alaska was the colonists, the merchants, the miners, the military, and other ne'er-do-wells like the politicians. So Alaska still belongs to the indigenous people, and we need the United States to recognize that and actually have a decolonization vote, which was never happened. And they need to have informed consent, which has never happened. So that's my addition to this conversation. Thank you.
All right, Chief Harrison, really appreciate those comments. And let's bring Kurt Chamberlain into this conversation now. He is Assistant General Counsel for the Calista Corporation. He's up in Anchorage. And Kurt, what's your thought on that? We just heard our caller, Chief Harrison, say Alaska, they need to have a decolonization vote. It was never actually purchased. It still belongs to the indigenous people. What's your thought?
So the question on there is very, very complicated, which is why there was which is what brought about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. So when it comes to establishing sovereignty, there's largely five recognized ways to do that. First is physical expansion of existing territories, which doesn't apply here. The other four do, though. The first one is cession, which is how the U.S. acquired its interest in Alaska, which is basically by purchasing Alaska from Russia. The third is acquisition by force, which the U.S. has a long history of doing. There's effective occupation or discovery, which is the Alaska Native claim, the Alaska Native's inherent right, which is basically first in time is first in right. First person there gets to claim the property. The last one, which also comes into heavy play, is prescription, which is effective occupation and exercise of sovereignty over time without objection from other states and countries. So what you had is you had the people of Alaska there first, and we held inherent title. And what Chief Gary is talking about, the limitation of the Russian interest in there, in Article 3 of the Treaty of Cession actually leaves a lot of the native rights and claims to the lands untouched. And in as the other people on the show have stated, they're correct that the native interests were largely ignored. And to a certain extent, it acted to our benefit, because in the 1860s, the United States interest in they actually stopped treating with natives and were sticking them on reservation. So had they acted in accordance with their policies at that time, we would have been in much, much more dire straits and given a much smaller percentage of our land. What we have is we have discovery versus what the Russians sold. At the time they sold, there were only about 200 or so Russian traders in Alaska. So their footprint was extremely small. But, you know, what they went there, they went and they claimed their interest in Alaska being the whole state. But what really complicates things is prescription, because the U.S. government and the non-native settlers came in and they started occupying and establishing laws and establishing jurisdiction and sovereignty over Alaska over time. And that's where it really comes into. And there's a case where the U.S. Challenged the Netherlands over the Islands of Palmas case. And the international arbitrator stated that in that case, the title of discovery, if it had not already been disposed by the treaties in effect at the time under the most favorable and expansive interpretation, exist only as an incoherent or natural title as a claim to establish sovereignty by effective occupation. However, that title cannot prevail over a definite title founded on continuous and peaceful display of sovereignty. And that was the two theories in conflict at the time ANCSA was settled. And so there was a lot of wiggle room and a lot of room for interpretation on how those were done. Now, there were a large number of court cases that established, you know, on our traditional hunt lands that we use, that Native Alaskans use, they did hold sovereignty over those. But establishing those and prevailing over those at the time were a big hurdle for a lot of our people, because a lot of our people didn't speak English at the time, couldn't read, couldn't write, and you were at an inherent disadvantage. Also, at the time of ANCSA, a lot of people agreed to that because they were afraid that the U.S. would simply take the land. And the U.S. does have a long history of taking land without consent. You know, if we were to object that, you know, this land was taken without our consent, we would be right in line with all 500 tribes in the U.S. Where a lot of their land was taken without their consent as well. So when ANCSA was affected, you know, I viewed the treaty, the purchase of Alaska, as a two-part purchase. The first part was the purchase of the Russian interest in the Treaty of Cession, and the rest was finalized in ANCSA. And so that was when Alaska finally became, you know, one united area. And there are goods and bads of both of it, but from the legal perspective, it's a very, very complex issue.
Well, Kurt, I'm curious, are there any unresolved land disputes that still hold over from around the time of that purchase and before ANCSA?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. ANCSA pretty much resolved just about all of it. Now, there's a lot of grumbling. There were unresolved issues, but as far as inherent title to the land, ANCSA was fairly clear on that. But regarding subsistence rights and a lot of those are very unresolved at this time.
All right. And for our listeners, I mean, what should they really be taking away here? What else do they need to understand about this early period of Alaska history, Kurt?
I think one of the biggest things to understand is a lot of our native leaders did the best they could at the time when ANCSA was enacted. And the Seward, you know, and my mother's maiden name is Kamroff. So although I'm Native Alaskan, I do have ties back to Russian fur traders by a very small portion of my relation. So I've got ties to it both. But I think the ultimate thing on Seward, I think it's what we faced before the Treaty of Session, and what we came out with now is far superior than what we would have been if had Seward not made the purchase. So I'm glad to be an American and not a Russian. Mm-hmm. But when our leaders acted in ANCSA, they did the best they could with what they had, and it was a very difficult process for a lot of people involved. So I think those are the very simple takeaways. I could go on for hours, but you don't have that much time on yourself.
All right, Kurt, appreciate it. Yeah, we got to take a break, in fact, but phone lines are open. Anybody else that would like to chime in on this conversation today? The territory of Alaska purchased from Russia by the United States in 1867 for the grand sum of $7.2 million. And today is Seward's Day, an Alaska state holiday. So give us a call if you'd like to add to this discussion. What do you think of Seward's Day? What does it mean to you? 1-800-996-2848. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk with Jackson Polis and get his take on the legacy of William Seward. So stay with us. We will be right back. Again, the phone number to talk to us here at the studio, 1-800-996-2848.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
You are listening to Native America Calling, and there's still time to join this conversation about Seward's Day and the purchase of Alaska. Join us with comments and questions at 1-800-996-2848. The number again, 1-800-996-2848. Let's hear from our next guest now, Jackson Polis. He is a multidisciplinary artist and carver. And Jackson, again, thank you for joining the show. And I know you have some very strong feelings about William Henry Seward. In fact, so much so that you made a shame poll of Seward. Start off by explaining, what exactly is a shame poll?
Yeah, thank you for joining me. I'll just preface this by saying thank you to the other guests on the show for providing important context about the Treaty of Session. And just, I think it's been important to hear about how that Treaty of Session actively avoided acknowledgement of Native people. It did allow for Russian Native Creoles to become citizens, but explicitly excluded the uncivilized man. So I think that's something to continue to think upon. I grew up carving in Saxman, Alaska, with my father, Nathan Jackson. I grew up carving totem poles for tourists who would come in off the cruise ships behind, busloads of tourists would come out and be given tours by Native Corporation tour guides. So I was in some way on display carving while simultaneously trying to invigorate what I understood to be my own culture. Part of that culture was growing up with this Seward shame pole, the second iteration in the Saxman Totem Park. And those pieces were carved in the 1940s under the Civilian Conservation Corps. And a lot of those pieces were reproductions of pieces that earlier existed. This was also the case for the Seward shame pole. The first pole was carved after Seward, after the purchase or the transaction, made a trip on a train out to San Francisco and then made a trip up to Klukwan in Southeast Alaska, the Native villages, to kind of see what he had purchased. He's often considered to be the first tourist. And it was also, heard through Tlingit people that he tried to coordinate his visit with a lunar eclipse so that the natives would think he was more powerful. But on his trip further south, after visiting Klukwan, he visited the Tontiquan Tlingit in southeast Alaska, and apparently by Chief Ebbets was given a number of gifts and did not repay those gifts. So there's a custom of a ridicule or a shame poll made for people who do not repay debts that had been expected of them. There's also a potlatch tradition of reciprocating gifts. So in all likelihood, he may have not known what he was expected to recontribute. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, a shame poll was made by him in the late 1800s, and it was remade in the Civilian Conservation Corps in 1941. And even at that time, when the U.S. government was attempting to provide funding for this activity, the Tlingit people there did not kind of divulge what the poll was actually depicting. It was only later that they found out that this was a figure criticizing and ridiculing a figure who had been responsible for that purchase. So much later on in 2014, that poll had begun to rot. And so I was hired by the city of Sacramento to remake that shame poll to keep that kind of legacy or counter monument alive.
Okay, so that original poll then had an esoteric theme to it, which is really fascinating. Jackson, tell us more about the poll that you carved. What does it look like, and in what way does it depict these negative traits of Seward?
Even before, there are many different modes of carving, I think, ways that one could ascribe meaning to different poles, but it's not necessarily whether or not a figure has like a large nose or a red nose or red ears. Those were some characteristics that were remarked upon before that third iteration that I made was remade. However, this idea that this is part of the ambiguity of that second iteration, right? That they wanted to kind of hide or smuggle in that meeting until after it was made, whether or not it would be a kind of ridicule poll. However, I did notice that it involves some kind of characterization or amplification of like a ridicule that was also found in some ways in terms of the distortion or the large head of argillite pieces in the Haida. And so these kind of depictions of Europeans were also something that was common at the time.
Well, Jackson, had you ever made a shame poll before?
No, that was the first time I had done one.
In that process, was it different for you than carving another type of pole?
Yeah, I mean, I'd grown up carving and been very interested in kind of continuing culture, but I think this opportunity presented a chance to court and kind of reckon with the complexity of that situation, whereby there was a refuse. Like, a lot of people think that Native people in general have no notion of property, and this goes back to John Locke and these mechanisms which were utilized for the expansion of territory, whereas maybe Tlingit people in particular maybe hyper-territorial compared to some other groups. And so it's this kind of range, which is interesting to me. And I think the refusal of ownership alongside the fact that this piece being recreated in a third iteration was a kind of marker of an unpaid debt, which often is connected in some ways to the ways in which clan crests are acquired. But here it kind of took on this this greater meaning with regard to the refusal of recognition of the sovereignty of the United States to claim ownership even now.
Mm-hmm. And Jackson, what kind of feedback are you getting on the shame poll?
It's been a little while now since I've done it. It was back in 2017 was when that was raised. There were a few different reasons for trying to keep it lower key in terms of whether or not the descendants of William Seward, some of them had been in talks with trying to see how they might be able to repay the debt. But at this point, I think it was also a collaboration with Klan leaders, so who also were in some sense not wanting to allow for such an easy kind of reconciliation to take place, because it might erase, as many acknowledgments do, erase the kind of complexity or marker of unpaid debt that this might signify. Yeah, I think it's been an interesting project and allows for the kind of continuance of shame pulls of a similar kind with the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in Juneau, Totem Projects, which also had that component of kind of unpaid debts. So in some sense, it's been great to see the kind of revitalization of this practice, which is also connected to these oral histories.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of history, Jackson, when you were growing up, what were they teaching in the schools there in Alaska about the purchase of the Alaska Territory? What do you remember about that, those lessons?
Much love to all my teachers, but I didn't really learn much.
Well, what did they say? Did they just ignore the impact on Native peoples? Did they just kind of talk about just the impact of Seward and the amount of money that was purchased? It was purchased for. I mean, what did they say?
Yeah, I think the general vibe was that this was something that was given, that this was now something that we come to accept, was a formation of reality. So there was no real opportunity, at least at that time, to kind of interrogate the kind of paucity of argument, or I would say the way that that's been opened up by some of the guests and the callers, the way that this didn't actually apply to Native people. They didn't highlight the fact that there was no consent. Perhaps mm-hmm. some of them did, but it was not something that felt like it could be acted upon. Whereas I feel now in this climate, I think there's a kind of resurgence of feelings of Native sovereignty and ability to act upon it and to voice the kind of refusals of ownership by another external power that we may not have felt at the time.
And what about here we are now, 2024? What do you know about how this history is taught in schools today there in Alaska? Has it changed?
I think that the more that this is written about, and the more legal scholarship is brought to the fore, the more there's opportunity for this to come about. I'm not sure 100% about the public school situation in Alaska. I know that's always a place for contestation, but I know that, like, in the University of Alaska Southeast, they've been actively wrestling with how to bring more Native voices to the fore. I think for me, individually, the risk is that one can talk about inclusion of Native voices into the overall framework and kind of ignore the tricky question of, does one need to accept that ultimately, long-term, this is where we're going to be, or how we're going to frame.
All right. Appreciate it, Jackson. Let's go back to Chief Gary Harrison. We have him back on the phone. Hello, Chief.
Hello. Well, one of the things in 1824, Russia tried to claim sovereignty over Alaska, and the United States and Great Britain both protested, saying, no, you couldn't claim sovereignty over Alaska because you neither discovered it nor have you conquered it. And that's in history books. The other thing is in the 30s, they brought the colonists up to the Matanuska Valley, which is where I live, which is why I know a lot about colonization. And they never did decolonize Alaska according to the UN Charter, which the United States helped write and signed and ratified. The other one is that in the Land Claims Act, it was a genocidal act. And if you listen to the Senate reports, it says in it that they didn't want it to be like the natives down in the States. So what they did is they made the corporations. And in this, they not only were trying to destroy the tribes in whole or in part, which is part of the Genocide Act and part of the Genocide Treaty, which the United States also signed and ratified, but they also left out the children, which is another sign of a plank of genocide. So this whole thing is made on genocide. And yes, I used to argue with my teacher in school about the land claims and about the taking of Alaska. And I have written several papers, which I have sent to the United Nations. And there has been a continuous thing from the indigenous peoples about the land claims, about that they've never... They shouldn't never be there, and we are disputing the land claims, and some people have disputed it from day one. So when the person said that it needed to be disputed, it has been. And I also got a legal opinion saying that from an international attorney. And so we're still claiming sovereignty, and we still claim our piece of Alaska, and I think that there needs to be a decolonization vote, an informed consent vote, and the United States needs to do that, and that way they can conform to the United Nations law, which they have said that treaties are the highest law of the land, which obviously they don't think so anymore, but we still need to hold them to that treaty which they signed. And that's my...
All right. Well, Chief Gary Harrison, really appreciate you chiming in on today's show. And I want to go back to Benjamin Jacek. Benjamin, I'm going to give you the last word here. And let's talk a little bit more about the present day and how this history is taught in schools. What's your thought on that? How should this history be taught in schools if it's not being done so already?
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, to be honest, adding the Native voice is absolutely imperative in an active way as opposed to a passive. But even still today, we're starting to learn more and more about the colonization of Alaska, you know, from the U.S.'s point of view. One thing, you know, in our research, because we've been doing a lot of boarding school research, is recognizing how ideologies that still really remain today. Maybe they might be dormant right now, but remain today, that really caused these individuals to, you know, push for these colonial realities. That also includes how alive these figures within Alaska state history, or, you know, the area of Alaska, are absolutely, you know, connected and working each other for this common goal. One thing we found out recently was and there is some correspondence going on between these individuals, but, William H. Seward was an alma mater of Union College, which he went to, his son actually went to with Shelton Jackson, you know, holding very similar views. And so you start to see this rollout of the supposed purchase of Alaska, this militarization period for in about a decade, and then the boarding school era coming through with Jackson. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. And I'm sorry, we are out of time. We're going to have to wrap up the show. But I want to thank all of our guests and callers who joined us today to talk about the complexity of Seward's Day in Alaska. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. We'll take a look at bullying in light of the death of an Oklahoma non-binary school student. Until then, I'm Sean Spruce. Thank you.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Act protects authentic American Indian and Alaska Native artists and craftspeople and their art and craftwork. Under the Act, it is illegal to market art or craftwork misrepresented as American Indian, Indian, Native American, or Alaska Native made, or as the product of a particular Indian tribe. Reporting potential Act violations can be done at doi.gov/IACB or at 1-888-ART-FAKE. Support provided by Indian Arts and Crafts Board.
Hakka, celebrate National Nutrition Month. Choose healthier food options for you and your loved ones. Sometimes it can be difficult to make good food choices, but there are many resources that can help. For more information, visit ihs.gov/diabetes or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.